You're about to launch to Planet Joe. Please enter the pod and fasten the brain safety belt. This planet is intended for mature humans only. If you are the sapient type that gets offended easily, please exit the pod immediately. Enjoy your visit on Planet Joe Pod. Launching now.
Hey, hey, my Earthlings, how you doing? Welcome to this crazy planet. Welcome, welcome. So how have you been? It's been a week. Step into the observatory and take a look at planet Earth at the distance. Because you're now on planet Joe and this crazy old planet. So how have you been? Hope you had a good week. I'm glad to see you here again. I'm glad you're coming back. And if this is your first landing here, then good fucking luck. Anyways, here's a question for you. Let's begin with a question. If you had two wishes that can come true, what would they be? Let's say if a genie comes out of a bottle and asks you, what are the two things that you would want and you can get them? What would you ask for? I know what I would ask for. Health and happiness. And I think that's what we all want in life. Health and happiness. To be healthy and to be happy. Now, I know many of you would say money. Wealth is in the equation, or must be. But that's why I said only two wishes. There are many wealthy people that are not happy. There are many wealthy people that are not healthy and therefore not happy. So I think the main thing, or the main two things that we all Earthlings on planet Earth want, is to be healthy and to be happy. Those are the two things. For ourselves and for our loved ones, right? If you'd ask, what is happiness? Do you think wealth can make you happy? I wondered that. But I got to tell you, I was fortunate enough to have that lesson at an early age. When I was 21, I opened a bar, which was a huge success, lots of money, but I wasn't happy. So that's why I'm saying fortunate enough that I had that experience of realizing that money doesn't make you happy. Now, don't get me wrong. Money helps. It can make you happier. That's for sure. And I've heard that saying more than once, usually from wealthy people. Whoever says money can't buy happiness doesn't know where to shop. I don't know how true it is. Yeah, we're going to talk about happiness. Let's put health aside. I'm not the type of person that would, talk about nutrition and exercising and all that. We all know that, contributes to being healthy, sleeping well, etc. But happiness, what are the two things? And this is the two things that contribute to happiness. And this is scientific. I'm not talking out of my ass. Those are the two things: connections and giving. You might ask what that is. Connections, we have that innate urge. It's in our DNA. A part of our evolution is to connect with other humans. If it's family members, if it's friends, coworkers, people in our community, it contributes a whole lot to happiness, to being happy. There were many studies and researches about this topic, and it's been proven time and again that connections with other human beings contributes a whole lot to happiness. And many researches have been done to prove the opposite, that loneliness is a contributor to being unhealthy and diseases and even leads to death. And loneliness, I think, is something that is growing on planet Earth. I think technology, as much as it's improving much of our lives, it contributes a lot to disconnecting with others. If you think about it, the younger generation, I don't know how skilled they are with communicating with others, with facing other human beings and talking face to face. I'm sure I'm not the only one that saw a family sitting in a restaurant and all family members are, you know, have their faces buried in their phones. If you look around when you walk down the street, people don't even know what's going on around them. I don't know how old you are, but for the younger generation, they never really had that experience of not having that technology, not being hooked on that technology. When I was growing up, boredom was a part of life. We were hanging out outside for hours on end. We'd find like branches and sticks to play with. There weren't no video games. The first thing that came out, this was my time, I can't remember how old I was the Atari. That was the first video game. But up until then, it was just interacting with others, other humans my age. Playing, fighting, hating, loving, laughing, crying. The whole palette of human emotions that I think the younger generation in our days lack. They don't know what it is. It's sad. And, you know, research and studies show that it's actually working against us. We're the loneliest society of our time due to technology. Sad but true. If you're expecting me to say what I think the solution is, I have no fucking clue. And I don't mean to sound pessimistic, but I think there is no solution. I think we're kind of doomed. I think it's going to get worse. You know, according to Yuval Noah Harari, no one in the world, not scientists, not, you know, anyone can say or can predict what's going to happen, where we're going to be in like 30, 40 years from now. When it comes to employment, when it comes to communications with each other, no one knows. But the path that we're going so far, it's pretty grim. Doesn't look good, especially for the younger generation. So connections, we lack connections in the last few years, and it's getting worse. The second thing, if you remember, we said connections and giving. Many studies and researches showed that giving contribute a whole lot to one's happiness. There's a whole lot of research around that. When people give with no expectations of getting back, it contributes a whole lot for their happiness. So here's another question. When was the last time you gave, you volunteered, you donated, you smiled at a stranger, you held a door to someone? Whatever it is, if you think about it, when was the last time you did it? I'm not going to sit here and preach and tell you what you should or shouldn't do. I'm guilty of it myself, but it's something that, you know, we all should look to improve, because not only it makes us happier, it makes others happy. And here's the beautiful thing about sapiens. This is in our DNA, you know, that's how we're wired. Giving makes us happy, period, bottom line. And this leads me to the next question, which I cannot for the life of me understand. Why are we, specifically Americans, politically and socially, why are we so divisive? Why are we so against each other? Why are we so stuck with our beliefs, and we're so stuck with our groups and circles? And if it's Republicans, Democrats, atheists, Muslims, Jews, tribes, why are we so stuck with our tribes? And it's fine to be a part of a tribe. But, you know, I'm old enough to notice that outsiders of the tribe are prone to hatred, literally. Disagreements are much more aggressive than I've ever seen before. And why is that? Think about it. We're all Americans. Let's focus on that tribe. America. Americans. Why can't we love each other and respect each other with our differences? Why can't we zoom out of our tribe and see the sufferings and the hardships of others? Now, don't get me wrong. I love America. I'm a fanatic, proud American. I don't know if you know me or if you've seen my pictures, but I have a nice tattoo sleeve on my left arm with a small American flag and the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department badge. And on my left upper arm on my bicep, I have a bald eagle with an American flag. And on my forearm, my future tattoo that I want to get, might be a little bit too crazy. I'm not locked on it. You might think and agree that it is crazy, but I want to get the American flag from my elbow all the way down to my wrist. The reason I'm telling you this is because I freaking love America. I'm willing to put my life down for America. But I'm not an extreme
USA, USA
type of guy. I see the flaws that our beautiful country has. And I get frustrated and angry with those that are extreme patriotic or extreme love for the country, extreme nationalists, if you will, that think that, you know, America is the greatest country in the world, yet they neglect the other Americans that are suffering. For example, the opioid epidemic. There are things that I'm not proud of America. I'm not proud to be American. Don't get me wrong. Love America. I'm a proud American. But there are a few things that I'm kind of ashamed, and it boggles my mind, like how such a powerful country has those flaws. And those things are racism, for one. No one can say that it doesn't exist in our country, unfortunately. Greed, when it comes to, you know, the one percenters who don't give a rat's ass about the small timers, poverty and all that. Healthcare. Big, big, big shame for me to live in such a powerful country, and healthcare is a sham, to say the least, compared to, you know, other successful countries. Healthcare is a disaster in our country. Sex phobia. This is a personal one for being a extreme sex positive creature. I think prostitution should be legalized. It's something that it boggles my mind. That's something that you can do for free and it's fine. But as long as there's money exchange, it's illegal. And all the resources that we waste on trying to fight it. Fighting it, it's such a bullshit term to say, because you can never win it. But yeah, America suffers from sex phobia. Alabama, anyone? When it comes to specifically sex phobia, I would say the roots of that behavior, the root of that ideology, the roots are religion, old-fashioned ideology, Stone Age book of a misogynistic imaginary dad in the sky that is sex phobic and misogynistic. That those are the roots of sex phobia is, but it's something that I'm not proud of America, and hoping, you know, that it will change. Even though I'm an activist, and especially for that, for positive sexuality, if you do know or if you don't, I'm not in America right now. I'm abroad. I'm in Israel. But when I do get back, I plan on getting aggressively active when it comes to sex positivity and legalizing prostitution. Planning on marching down the White House with many people. Bottom line, my people, is that America is run by old people. America is run by our grandparents. It's sad. I mean, that's the energy that our government has. It's old people. It just smells like, you know, the old people's perfume, old people's cologne. That's what the American government smells like. Old people that are disconnected from reality, from what goes on with the everyday American. I'm going to get into that in a minute. I don't know if you heard of represent.us or .us. It's a wonderful movement that's marching with goals of changing Congress and changing our whole political system. You know what? Let me run by you a clip about represent.us. It's a 12-minute clip by Jennifer Lawrence. She's a spokeswoman of represent.us. Beautiful Jennifer Lawrence. But anyways, she'll explain exactly what this movement is. And if you're not familiar with it, if you're an American, I urge you, actually I beg you, to join, sign up, volunteer, donate, do whatever you can. But first, listen to what is it all about. Here's Jennifer Lawrence with represent.us. 12 minutes. I'll see you in 12 minutes.
We are witnessing a total political system failure in America. If you're anything like me, you may find yourself constantly overwhelmed by everything that's wrong with politics. And when I say politics, I'm not talking about Democrats or Republicans. I'm talking about the flaws that exist in our political system, regardless of which party is in power. And I know it's hard to talk about politics these days, but look, the government is ours. We pay for it, so it needs to work for us. And right now it doesn't. And I mean, it really doesn't. So what's going on here? Is it Russian meddling in social media? Is it him? Is it her? No. Those two were the least least popular presidential candidate since they began keeping track of such things. Only 4% of Americans have a great deal of confidence in Congress now. Just 4%. America is no longer even considered a full democracy. We are witnessing a total political system failure in America, which is the complete opposite of what our nation's founders had in mind. So I'm going to show you three lines that show what's causing this failure, how we can fix it, and what you can do about it. So here's your first line. What I want you to do is take any issue you really care about and picture it on this line. This line comes from a Princeton University study that shows how public opinion influences the laws that Congress does or doesn't pass. They looked at 1,800 public opinion polls over a 20-year period, and we took their data and plotted it in this chart. See this horizontal line? That shows public support for a law amongst average Americans. This vertical line? That shows the likelihood of the public support leading to the passage of a law. When you plot it for the average American, you get a line that looks like this. There's your issue sitting on that line. If there is zero support for a law, there's about a 30% chance that Congress is going to pass it. And if there is 100% support for something, the most popular thing ever, there's still a 30% chance that Congress is going to pass it. So the line is horizontal because no matter how much support there is among average Americans, there's still a 30% chance that Congress is going to pass that law. Princeton determined that the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact on public policy. How in the hell does that happen? Consider this. Politicians are spending up to 70% of their time raising funds for re-election after they get into office. Why? Because in order to win a seat in the Senate in some races, you would have to raise $45,000 every single day, 365 days a year for 6 years to raise enough money to win. Now consider that only 0.05% of Americans give more than $10,000 to politics. And then you see why politicians have become completely dependent on the 0.05% of Americans, billionaires and special interest groups, who fund their campaigns. Meanwhile, you've got lobbyists writing our laws and donating to the politicians who pass them. We have a two-party duopoly of Democrats and Republicans that makes it so that independents can't win, while the American people are leaving the major parties in droves. As you can see here, nearly half of American voters are now registered independent. And then there's gerrymandering, with politicians drawing the boundaries of their own voting districts into crazy shapes designed to prevent competition. Today, only 14% of House campaigns are actually competitive. 86% of them are not. And we wonder why young people feel that their vote doesn't matter. I've covered a lot here, but it all adds up to this vast ring of influence over our elected leaders. It's a corrupt system in which we, the people, have near zero influence over our own government. And that is sad. That is not the country I feel like I grew up in. But what's worse is that by allowing this to happen, we are causing the failure of the most important issues facing our nation. We're wasting trillions of dollars a year on fraud and abuse in our own government. 1 in 5 American children live in poverty. Our health care is the most expensive in the world. We have more people in prison per capita than Russia and China. We're losing jobs to the rest of the world. And we're not even doing enough to keep our air and our water clean for our children. America was founded on the promise of self-governance, but instead we have statistically non-significant impact on public policy. So the question is, how do we unrig this system? I'm obsessed with this idea, not just of unrigging it, but actually fixing it. That's when I met Josh.
This is it. This is the issue behind the issues. If we fix the system, we'll have so much more power to fix everything else. So I spoke to some of the most brilliant people in the country. Constitutional scholar Lawrence Lessig, Zephyr Teachout, and dozens of other constitutional constitutional scholars and experts and strategists. They all said the same thing. You could pass a law that would stop political bribery and fix our broken elections. And if you could do that, you could wrest power away from the corrupt establishment and put it back in the hands of the people. Here's how you fix our broken elections. End gerrymandering with independent redistricting commissions.
Create ranked choice voting so third parties and independents can run and win.
Implement automatic voter registration and vote from home.
And here's how we can crack down on political bribery. Overhaul lobbying and ethics laws and close the revolving door so politicians can't be bribed with high-paying job offers.
Mandate full transparency of political spending so we know who's trying to buy influence.
Give every voter a $50 or $100 tax voucher so politicians spend time fundraising from their constituents, not just that 0.05% that I talked about earlier.
If you could pass even just some of these reforms, you would undo that ring of influence and begin to reinstate we the people as the most important influence over our elected leaders. So we took all of these reforms and put them in a model law and named it the Anti-Corruption Act. And get this, 87% of Americans support making the Anti-Corruption Act the law of the land. Look at the breakdown, 91% of Democrats and 83% of Republicans. It's incredible. Now, you might be thinking, 9 out of 10 Americans, surely Congress will pass it. But on this issue, more than any other issue, it's like asking the fox to put a lock on the hen house. Politicians won in the current system, and they have an incentive not to fix it. So we need to go around Congress, in this case, by passing anti-corruption acts in cities and states all across America. Now, every time I say this, people look at me and say, how does passing city and state laws lead to fixing all of these problems with the federal government?
Can I do this part?
Go for it.
So, first of all, the U.S. Constitution gives states sole control over how elections are run, even federal elections. So when we fix gerrymandering or election laws, that fixes a federal election in each state. That means that by going state by state, we have an immediate impact on how we elect Congress and how we hold them accountable. But there's more, and that brings us to our second line. This line is from a Bloomberg News study. It finds that throughout American history, passing state laws leads to federal victory. Let me show you what I mean. This chart shows the number of states over time that pass laws giving women the right to vote. When it hits the right side of the chart, that's the federal victory. Okay, now I want you to watch the blue line. We're going to do this again with interracial marriage. There were a few states in the Northeast that made it legal decades ago, and centuries go by, and we hit this blue line where all of a sudden there's a rush of activity, which leads pretty quickly to federal passage. So here we are again with same-sex marriage. One state, Massachusetts, for many years. A couple decades later, we hit that blue line, a jump in state activity and federal passage. This isn't about these issues. This is about a winning political strategy. The crucial finding in the Bloomberg study is that a key event, often a court decision or a grassroots campaign reaching maturity, triggers a rush of state activity that ultimately leads to a change in federal law. So fixing this problem is possible, but how do we create our trigger moment for this issue? Well, the grassroots campaign from the study, that's represent us. We're bringing conservatives and progressives together to pass anti-corruption laws all across America using 3 strategic innovations: right-left coalitions, calling out corruption, and building a movement, a big movement. And I'm going to break them down for you.
Can I do this part?
No. First, right-left. This is how people self-identify in America. This isn't party identification. This is how you feel politically. And as you can see, it's 25% liberal, 36% conservative, and 34% moderate. But for the past 40 years and the reforms I've outlined, it's liberals speaking to liberals using liberal language with liberal messengers. Liberal. I just had to say that one more time. And you're just not going to change the political power structure of America with 25% of the people. Fixing corruption requires that we enlist all Americans, liberal, conservatives, and moderates, who, as we've shown, overwhelmingly support reform. Number 2, corruption. When we talk about money in politics, gerrymandering, democracy, campaign finance reform, most people just tune out. But people are fired up about corruption. And number 3, we must build a movement, a big movement, comprised of all kinds of people from all across America fighting to pass anti-corruption laws, and then make sure they are implemented and protected. So again, liberals and conservatives working together, corruption, and build a movement. This is the foundation of Represent Us. We believe the government should work for every American, not just a handful of billionaires and special interests. But it's not just an idea. In a few years, we've already racked up 85 wins all across the country. And if we can get those 85 wins to 850 wins, we can fix our corrupt political system, save America, and get to work on fixing everything else that's broken in our country. This is how we build this movement big enough to trigger that rush of state activity that leads to a change in federal law. And that brings us to our last line. Right now, this is you. And right now, these are all of the ways that you can help us go state by state, city by city, to fix the corruption in American politics. Volunteer and join a Represent Us chapter. Or, if that's not your thing, join the Commonwealth to make a monthly donation in support of someone who does volunteer. 100% of your money goes straight to passing these laws, not to overhead or our expenses. Every voice matters. Your voice matters. If you do nothing, nothing changes. But if we all do a little, we can win together. So the only question left is this. Will you cross that line? Join us at represent.us.
Yeah, bottom line is we gotta get up. Get our asses up and start doing shit. Otherwise, nothing will happen. And I think that's the biggest problem that we have in America, that people lost hope in our government and they're not doing anything. And if you listen carefully, a lot of it, a lot of those thoughts or those feelings that we can't make a change is for a good reason. Because no matter what we do or what we vote for, Congress makes the last call. And the only way around it is to get up and do things. And that's why I encourage you. Represent.us. Go there. And let's start the movement and make some changes so we can help all Americans, not just red or blue, Republicans, Democrats, whatever. There is hope. I'm very hyped with that movement. I gotta admit, though, that their whole marketing strategy kind of sucks. If you go to the website, you see, first of all, represent.us is not, it's not a brand that can you know, get people fired up in the way they promote it and all that. But the cause and the intention is unbelievably powerful and necessary. So regardless, I hope you will join and watch how we make a difference. Anyways, okay, so I mentioned that there have been tons of research on that topic of connections and giving. A favorite website that you can find legitimate information about those researches is Greater Good Magazine. If you go, this is a Berkeley University in Southern California. If you want to check it out, go to greatergood.berkeley.edu. It's a Greater Good Magazine. Science-based insights for a meaningful life. Great stuff about this topic. So let me read a little bit from what I gathered and from what I think most of us already knew. But let's hear it from, you know, from the data and the research that came out from how human connections and giving actually makes us happier and gives us meaning. So the first article, the title is "What is Social Connection?" So here it is. When researchers refer to the concept of social connection, they mean the feeling that they belong to a group and generally feel close to other people. Scientific evidence strongly suggests that this is a core psychological need, essential to feeling satisfied with your life. Indeed, humans are profoundly social species. Our drive to connect with others is embedded in our biology and evolutionary history. It begins at birth in our relationship with our caregiver, and the effects of this relationship seems to reverberate throughout our lives. When we're cared for as children, we're more likely to have healthy, secure attachments as we get older. What's more, the pleasures of social life register in our brains much the same way physical pleasures do
do.
And our knack for social connection is reflected in some of the most basic ways humans communicate, by subtle uses of our voice, facial expressions, and sense of touch. Scientists believe we are essentially wired to connect with other people because natural selection favored humans with a stronger propensity to care for their offsprings and organize into groups. To the extent that we can characterize evolution as designing our modern brains, this is what our brains were wired for, reaching out to and interacting with others. This is what Matthew Liberman writes in his book, Social, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. He's a neuroscientist. These social adaptations are central to making us the most successful species on Earth. So yeah, that's the first article, which is interesting nonetheless. Let me read another one from the same website, Greater Good Magazine. This article is by Dr. Elizabeth Hopper, titled How to Build Connections in a Dehumanized World. A new book explores why dehumanization might be increasing in modern society and what we can do about it. And this is what I mentioned and talked about before. Thanks to technology, we can work remotely, interacting with colleagues online rather than face-to-face. We can order our groceries and meals through delivery apps, so we don't have to go out to stores and restaurants. We can look for information online instead of asking someone else for answers. While technology offers us more convenience, it has a downside. It has decreased our contact with others, creating a society where we're more independent, but also potentially lonelier and less empathetic toward the people around us. Which is a shame, and this is not in the article. That's what I'm saying. It's a shame. Adam Waits of the Kellogg School of Management at Northeastern University explores the implications of this societal change in his new book, The Power of Human, How Our Shared Humanity Can Help Us Create a Better World. So he wrote, I realize that human-less experience is greatly deficient compared to a more human one, even if it comes at the expense of convenience, he writes. One big problem is that this societal shift may lead to an increase in dehumanization, that is, seeing others as less than fully human, which is shockingly commonplace, consequential, and also curable, Waits writes. In his book, he outlines how this increase in dehumanization has happened and how we can go about rebuilding the human connection that is so important to our relationships and our communities. So, is dehumanization increasing? According to Waits, dehumanization can be defined as neglecting another person's mind or not recognizing that other people have thoughts of their own and are capable of feeling complex emotion. According to Waits, dehumanization can be defined as neglecting other person's mind or not recognizing that other people have thoughts of their own and are capable of feeling complex emotions. Humanization, on the other hand, means acknowledging that others have complex minds and intrinsic worth as human beings. Humanization and dehumanization may have natural basis, as studies have shown that we have mentalizing networks that we use when thinking about others' mental states. Research finds that when people view members of groups that are commonly dehumanized, such as homeless individuals or people struggling with addiction, their mentalizing networks show less activation. And again, this basically just strengthens, you know, everything I'm saying about how disconnected we are. Although researchers haven't studied this directly, a variety of related trends may indicate that humanization is increasing, Waits argues. He cites evidence that people are lonelier and less trusting than in the past decades. We're also less connected to our communities, and we tend to be more isolated. In addition, research suggests that empathy has decreased between 1979 and 2009. However you interpret this decline, Waits emphasized that something about our relationship with others has changed over the past few decades. And this is exactly what I said, that, you know, I'm old enough that I've seen that change, that I've seen that separation between humans, between our neighbors and friends and coworkers and whatnot. It has declined. That's unfortunate, but it's a fact. Okay, let me, real quick, one last article from the same place, Greater Good Magazine. Again, this one is also by Dr. Elizabeth Hopper, titled, Can Helping Others Help You Find Meaning in Life? New research is finding that being kind and giving to others can make our lives feel more meaningful. And I strongly agree with that. So here goes, let me read this for you. The idea that helping others is part of a meaningful life has been around for thousands of years. Aristotle wrote that finding happiness and fulfillment is achieved by loving rather than in being loved. According to the psychologist Carol Rif, who reviewed the writings of numerous philosophers throughout history, relationships with others are a central feature of a positive, well-lived life. Yet today, many of us seem to be struggling to find meaning by gathering up achievements, spending so much time at work that we're cut off from other people. Often psychologists have distinguished between two types of well-being: hedonic well-being, a sense of happiness, and eudaimonic, which is well-being, a sense of meaning and purpose. Although happiness and meaning overlap significantly, researchers suspected that helping others is especially crucial to developing a sense of meaning. A recent article published in the Journal of Positive Psychology by Daryl Van Tengeren and his colleagues sought to examine this relationship. In a preliminary study, the researchers asked over 400 participants to report on how frequently they engage in different altruistic behaviors, such as volunteering, for example, and how meaningful their life feels. Participants who were more altruistic reported a greater sense of purpose and meaning in their lives. According to Van Tengeren, engaging in altruistic acts may allow us to find fulfillment because it improves our relationships. Another factor that might come into play is detailed in the 2010 study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. According to this article, when we choose to engage in pro-social actions, it helps to meet our basic psychological needs. For autonomy, feeling that we have freely chosen our actions; competence, feeling that we're good and capable; and relatedness, feeling close to others. So helping others is beneficial because it fulfills basic human needs. And that altruism may be especially important for strengthening our relationships and connecting us with others. And that's what I'm saying. The more you give, the happier you are. I just wanted to bring that up. So, my dear earthlings, all I'm saying is we have to be active politically and not let our grandmas and grandpas run this country, and not let the 1%ers buy out governors and senators and politicians and even presidents. We have to take control over our country, and it's possible. It's hard work. It's not going to be in a day or a month. It's going to take some time, but I'm saying we can do it, and we need to do it. As much as we're busy with our lives and work and family and whatnot, I'm sure we can find some time to join represent.us or any movement that you believe that is unbiased. That's the important thing, you know. If you're locked down with your own tribe, Republicans, Democrats, religious affiliation, whatever it is, you're doing it wrong. It's not the right way to go. You don't care about others outside your tribe. All I'm saying is let's zoom out. Try to zoom out. Try to lift your head above your tribe and see what's going on outside of that circle. And I think that'll be a good motivator to maybe start seeing that we're all humans, we're all Americans, and we all have the same challenges. And all we want is to be healthy and happy. It's all we want, all of us. So when it comes to loving America, like I'm a true patriotic, fanatic, crazy, love America, but I'm not a tribal member that's locked into my beliefs. I'm not afraid to criticize my country. And you know, a good way to describe it, it's like a parent-child kind of a relationship. You know, we love our parents, but they're not perfect, even though they're trying and they have good intentions. I honestly believe that many people in our government and many leaders have good intentions, but they're disconnected. So that's why I'm not ashamed to criticize the country that I love so much. And I think it's the best way to stay humble and to be neutral and unbiased is to say, I love this country. I'm willing to put my life on the line for this country, but there are things that need to be changed or improved. Hey, have you heard of the show? You probably did, The Newsroom with Jeff Daniels. It was a while ago. I can't remember how long ago it was on Showtime. But anyways, one of the greatest written speeches about why America is not the greatest country in the world anymore was, I think it was on The Pilot Show. I don't remember which episode. I've seen only like two episodes of it. It wasn't that great. But this speech is freaking amazing. Jeff Daniels is, I think he was like an executive of a news channel company or something. And this is, they had a Q&A in this auditorium, and one of the students asked him something along the lines like, well, we're the greatest country in the the world. And then he goes off and explains why we're not the greatest country in the world anymore. Anyways, I'm going to play this for you. It's a few minutes, 4 or 5 minutes. No, 2.5 minutes. It's 2.5 minutes long. Titled, Why America Isn't the Greatest Country in the World Anymore by Jeff Daniels. You can look it up on YouTube. And it's freaking amazing. I could not have said it better. I think the stats are much worse now than they were back then when he made that speech. But here it is. Why America isn't the greatest country in the world anymore.
Because they lose. If liberals are so fucking smart, how come they lose so goddamn always?
Hey,
and with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And yeah, you, sorority girl, just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is, there is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories. Number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation, period, ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yosemite? Sure used to be. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed, we cared about our neighbors, we put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chests. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars, acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. It didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to be all these things and do all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. First step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore.
That's a great speech that describes where we're at. And you shouldn't be afraid to look at the flaws because, you know, one of the greatest lines he said is that the first thing we have to do is recognize that there is a problem. If we just stand up and shout,
USA, USA,
and think we're the greatest country in the world while we're sliding down the ranks of where we're at in the world, We got to wake up. We got to start doing shit. And if we don't, it's just going to keep going that way. And it's sad. Speaking of which, let's get on funny tone a little bit. Jim Jefferies. You know Jim Jefferies? One of my favorite comedians nowadays. Australian guy who lives in the US. You probably know who he is. Anyways, he has a Netflix special since 2017. It's called Freedom. But I recorded the 7-minute snippet for you of Jim talking about America and freedom. And it's wonderful to hear it from an outsider. And honestly, he's so right. So true. 7 minutes. Here it is. Let's get a little laugh. Jim Jefferies, Freedom.
And then they always say this, and this fucking spins me out. Well, I don't expect an Australian to understand freedom. What are you talking about? You constantly say freedom all the time. Like, you're the, oh, we're so free. We fight for freedom, freedom, freedom. Come to the Freedom Lounge at the airport. Like, fucking what? You know when you're singing the national anthem at the baseball and the person holds the note free for a little bit longer than they should until all you Americans fucking come in your pants? For the land of the free. So free. Freedom, is freedom, though. Free, free, free. Now, I hate to break it to you, because I don't think many of you know this. There are 92 free countries on the planet. Democratic free countries. You are one of them. Every single English-speaking country on Earth is free, and most of the countries are also free. Now, you're very free. Don't get upset. And I have a wonderful... I love America. I truly do. I live here and I love it. I have nothing against it. And none of the things I'm about to mention affect you. It may affect me in any way, right? You may not be the freest place on earth. Just a quick example, out of the 92 free countries on the planet, you have the highest rate of incarceration. 1% of your adult population is in prison. That's double that of the country that comes in second, which is South Africa. If you've ever been to South Africa, South Africa's fucked. So you're double that of South Africa. So statistically, in the land of the free, you have the least amount of free people. This is a super simple one, super simple argument. In Holland, you can smoke weed whilst fucking a hooker in front of a cop. How dare Holland not be called the land of the free? Do you honestly think you're competing with Holland? In Canada, just last year, they legalized assisted suicide for the sick, which I believe is the biggest freedom of them all. It's your life. No government, no religious group should ever tell you when you get to check out. If you're a pro-life person, good. Do it with your life, not mine. Okay? Now, and also, I don't think they've thought about it. I don't think there's even the most evangelical Christian who's a burn victim just, like, hanging onto life support in a hospital just, I feel so free. And I'm so glad they're doing it in Canada, because if I ever had an assisted suicide, I wanted to be a Canadian doctor. I want some guy rocking up to my house like, okay, you're ready then. So I hear that someone's given up on life, eh? All right, let me just set up my little death machine here, and I'm going to put this in your vein, and you're going to be so sleepy so soon, I tell you what there. In Australia, maybe 20 years ago, maybe 20, they legalized prostitution. They thought it would be the downfall of our society, but it really wasn't. It was a great thing. Like in Sydney, where I grew up, the streets always had hookers walking around everywhere. There was needles, and it was a very seedy city in some parts, you know. And then what they did was they legalized prostitution. They moved all the hookers into brothels. And because they moved into brothels, all the girls had to be tested for STDs. And then the guys, they could see the tests as they go in. So it was safer for the men, but it was also safer for the women. Because what they did was they put security in these brothels. So if you showed up like a drunk idiot, they wouldn't let you in. Or if you got a bit aggro, they'd kick you the fuck out. So the girls were safer, the men were safer. Human trafficking was all but eliminated. And the tax revenue went up. And the divorce rate dropped by 8%. There is no downside to legalized prostitution. Now, in America, prostitution is illegal unless you film it. How the fuck is that possible? How do you have the biggest porn industry in the world and you still have illegal prostitution? Because it is legal to pay a woman for sex, but your friend Dave has to be in the corner with a camera. And Dave has to film it. And Dave has to promise to put it on the internet, because if Dave doesn't put it on the internet, then a crime is being committed. And And that girl can be 18 years old. And then she can be surrounded by 10 men that she barely knows. And they can all jack off onto her face until she's glazed with cum. And no crime has been committed. But in America, and only in America, she's too young to have a beer. If anyone deserves a beer in the land of the free, the home of the brave, it's the girl with 10 loads of cum in her face. In fact, if you have 10 loads of cum in your face, you should get free drinks wherever you go. You seem like a fun girl. Or a heavy sleeper.
Yeah, Jim Jeffries is great, I'm telling you. Just so you know, the facts that he was joking about when it comes to legalizing prostitution, these are all facts. It's all true in Australia. Divorce rates did drop 8%. Drugs went down. Crime went down. It was just, there's no downside to legalizing prostitution. And I'm going to dive into depth in future episodes about legalizing prostitution. Same thing with legalizing drugs. Not decriminalizing, but legalizing drugs. I'm so for it. And we have a great example of how wonderful the results are when you legalize drugs, and that's in Portugal. Do you know who Johan Hari is? This guy's a smart cat. I think I first heard of him when he was on Joe Rogan's podcast, and he's an advocate for legalizing drugs. British guy, very smart guy. His specialty is addiction, overall addiction, not just drug addiction. But he lost a couple of family members to drug addictions, and he's devoting his life on that topic. So here it is. One more audio snippet, 8.5 minutes, TED Talk, Johan Hari talking about addiction. This TED Talk is titled, Everything You Think You Know About Addiction Is Wrong. Open up your ears and open up your mind for this one. Everything you think you know about addiction is wrong. Johan Hari. TED Talk. Here it is.
You get a rat and you put it in a cage and you give it two water bottles. One is just water and the other is water laced with either heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will almost always prefer the drugged water and almost always kill itself quite quickly. So there you go, right? That's how we think it works. In the 70s, Professor Alexander comes along and he looks at this experiment and he noticed something. He said, we're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do except use these drugs. Let's try something a bit different. So Professor Alexander built a cage that he called Rat Park, which is basically heaven for rats, right? They've got loads of cheese, they've got loads of colored balls, they've got loads of tunnels. Crucially, they've got loads of friends, they can have loads of sex, and they've got both the water bottles, the normal water and the drugged water. But here's the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, they don't like the drugged water. They almost never use it. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdose. You go from almost 100% overdose when they're isolated to 0% overdose when they have happy and connected lives. Now, when he first saw this, Professor Alexander thought, you know, maybe this is just a thing about rats. They're quite different to us, you know, maybe not as different as we'd like, but, you know. But fortunately, there was a human experiment into the exact same principle happening at the exact same time. It was called the Vietnam War. In Vietnam, 20% of all American troops were using loads of heroin. And if you look at the news reports from the time, they were really worried because they thought, my God, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the United States when the war ends. It made total sense. Now, those soldiers who were using loads of heroin were followed home. The Archives of General Psychiatry did a really detailed study. And what happened to them? It turns out they didn't go to rehab. They didn't go into withdrawal. 95% of them just stopped. Now, if you believe the story about chemical hooks, that makes absolutely no sense. But Professor Alexander began to think there might be a different story about addiction. He said, what if addiction isn't about your chemical hooks? What if addiction is about your cage? What if addiction is an adaptation to your environment? Looking at this, there was another professor called Peter Cohen in the Netherlands who said, maybe we shouldn't even call it addiction. Maybe we should call it bonding. Human beings have a natural and innate need to bond. And when we're happy and healthy, we'll bond and connect with each other. But if you can't do that, because you're traumatized or isolated or beaten down by life, you will bond with something that will give you some sense of relief. Now, that might be gambling, that might be pornography, that might be cocaine, that might be cannabis, but you will bond and connect with something because that's our nature. That's what we want as human beings. And a core part of addiction, I came to think, and I believe the evidence suggests, is about not being able to bear to be present in your life. Now, this has really significant implications. The most obvious implications are for the war on drugs, right? But actually, almost everywhere in the world, we treat addicts to some degree like that. We punish them, we shame them, we give them criminal records, we put barriers between them reconnecting. There was a doctor in Canada, Dr. Gabor Mate, an amazing man, who said to me, if you wanted to design a system that would make addiction worse, you would design that system. Now, there's a place that decided to do the exact opposite, and I went there to see how it worked. In the year 2000, Portugal had one of the worst drug problems in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, which is kind of mind-blowing. And every year, they tried the American way more and more. They punished people and stigmatized them and shamed them more. And every year, the problem got worse. And one day, the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition got together and basically said, look, we can't go on with a country where we're having ever more people becoming heroin addicts. Let's set up a panel of scientists and doctors to figure out what would genuinely solve the problem. And they set up a panel led by an amazing man called Dr. Joao Goulao to look at all this new evidence. And they came back and they said, decriminalize all drugs, from cannabis to crack. But, and this is the crucial next step, take all the money we used to spend on cutting addicts off, on disconnecting them, and spend it instead on reconnecting them with the society. And that's not, essentially, that's not really what we think of. What they did wasn't really what we think of as drug treatment in the United States and Britain. So they do residential rehab, they do psychological therapy that does have some value. But the biggest thing they did was the complete opposite of what we do. A massive program of job creation for addicts and microloans for addicts to set up small businesses. So say you used to be a mechanic. When you're ready, they go to a garage and they'll say, if you employ this guy for a year, we'll pay half his wages. The goal was to make sure that every addict in Portugal had something to get out of bed for in the morning. And when I went and met the addicts in Portugal, it was fascinating. What they said is, as they rediscovered purpose, they rediscovered bonds and relationships with the wider society. It'll be 15 years this year since that experiment began, and the results are in. Injecting drug use is down in Portugal, according to the British Journal of Criminology, by 50%, 50%. Overdose is massively down. HIV is massively down among addicts. Addiction in every study is significantly down. One of the ways you know it's worked so well is that almost nobody in Portugal wants to go back to the old system. Now, that's the kind of political implications. I actually think there's a layer of implications to all this research below that. You know, we live in a culture where people feel really increasingly vulnerable to all sorts of addictions, whether it's to their smartphones or to shopping or to eating. You know, before these talks began, you guys know this, that we were told we weren't allowed to have our smartphones on. And I have to say, a lot of you looked an awful lot like addicts who were being told their dealer was going to be unavailable for the next couple of hours. And, you know, a lot of us feel like that. And it might sound weird to say, oh, you know, I've been talking about how disconnection is a major driver of addiction, but weird to say it's growing because you think, well, we're the most connected society there's ever been, surely. But I increasingly began to think that the connection we have, the connections we have, we think we have, are like a kind of parody of human connection. If you have a crisis in your life, you'll notice something. It won't be your Twitter followers who come to sit with you. It won't be your Facebook friends who help you turn it round. It'll be your flesh and blood friends who you have deep and nuanced and textured face-to-face relationships with. And I think there's a study I learned about from Bill McKibben, the environmental writer, I think tells us a lot about this. It looked at the number of close friends the average American believes they can call on in a crisis. That number has been declining steadily since the 1950s. The amount of floor space an individual has in their home has been steadily increasing. And I think that's like a metaphor for the choice we've made as a culture, right? We've traded floor space for friends. We've traded stuff for connections. And the result is that we are one of the loneliest societies there has ever been. And yet, Bruce Alexander, the guy who did the Rat Park experiment, says, we talk all the time in addiction about individual recovery. And it's right to talk about that. But we need to talk much more about social recovery. Something's gone wrong with us, not just as individuals, but as a group. And we've created a society where, for a lot of us, life looks a whole lot more like that isolated cage and a whole lot less like Rat Park. But if I'm honest, this isn't why I went into it, right? I didn't go in to discover the political stuff, the social stuff. I wanted to know how to help the people I love. And when I came back from this long journey and I'd learned all this, I looked at the addicts in my life, and if you know, if you're really candid, it's hard loving an addict, and there's going to be lots of people who know in this room you're angry a lot of the time. And I think one of the reasons why this debate is so charged is because it runs through the heart of each of us, right? Everyone has a bit of them that looks at an addict and thinks, I wish someone would just stop you. And the kind of script we're told for how to deal with the addicts in our lives is typified by, I think, by the reality show Intervention. If you guys haven't seen it, I think everything in our lives is typified by reality TV, but that's another TED talk. If you've never seen the show Intervention, it's a pretty simple premise. You get an addict, all the people in their life gather them together and say, if you don't shape up, confront them with what they're doing, and they say, if you don't shape up, we're going to cut you off, right? So what they do is they take the connection to the addict and they threaten it. They make it contingent on the addict behaving the way they want. And I began to see why that approach doesn't work. And I began to think that almost that's like the importing of the logic of the drug war into our private lives.
Isn't it amazing how science aligns with nature? Sorry that I cut this off. Just goes off topic here a little bit, but you should check it out, this TED Talk. But anyways, I'm just amazed like how science and research is aligned with nature. The more we help others, even addicts, the better their chances are of recovering and becoming, you know, part of a society. This is one of the things that I'm so against, like ex-convicts, how they're shunned from society. They can't vote even after they're released from prison. They can't get a job. They just can't get back to life. And this is what I've been talking about from the beginning, about caring and giving, how it also helps people with, you know, the most, I don't know, harsh addictions that you can imagine. If they're surrounded with love and support, they overcome it. That's what he was talking about in Portugal, like how they legalized drugs and had clinics where drug addicts can walk in and have heroin and cocaine and whatnot as much as they want. And it's not illegal, but it's the support that's what, you know, helps them beat that addiction. You know, shamefully, we in America have the opposite approach, and that's pushing opioids and drugs on our citizens. And the overdose rates, overdose deaths that are happening in America is a disgrace. You know, it's increasing year by year. Our fellow Americans are dying, and we're just looking the other way. And it's shameful. It's something that I'm terribly embarrassed when it comes to being an American, that we don't zoom out of our little circle, of our family, of our community, and looking around us and seeing the sufferings of others and lending a hand and volunteering, helping, whatever needs to be done. But I think the main thing is that we have to fight to change those laws. We really do, because all of these laws are only to benefit big pharma and the 1%ers and the billionaires who don't give a rat's ass about everyday Americans who suffer because they want to make the dough. They want to make the dollar, if you will. And you know, one of the most amazing things that happened to me when I fully became an atheist, when my eyes opened, the most amazing thing that I didn't expect, you know what it was? It was a surprise, I gotta admit. Not only all of a sudden I had much more value to life, because there is no soul, there's no other life, there's no continuity, it's finite. The moment I became an atheist, I realized that life is finite, and that made life much more valuable. But more importantly, it made me appreciate other people's lives, other humans, much more than before. Even though, and don't get me wrong, I know a lot of religious people care and donate and whatever, but they're not even aware of it. The ones that, you know, believe in deity and afterlife and seeing their loved ones, and they feel like it's a waiting station over here. It continues. Something changes when you realize that this is it. This is all we have. And I remember in that moment, my care for others increased tenfold. And I'm not saying I didn't care before. I did, but I don't know if you get it. Maybe only atheists can understand what I'm talking about. But for theists, it's subconsciously, it's like people die and they go and they see their loved ones and they continue, and there's an afterlife, and subconsciously appreciation for life, it's less. No theist will ever admit it because they're not aware of it. But for me, that was the biggest surprise when I opened my eyes, when my eyes opened and faith was gone and I realized life is finite. And this is it. This is all we have. There's nothing after this. all of a sudden, human life became so fragile and so important. And that made me care for others even more and care for my own life even more and appreciate life even more. But anyways, future episodes, I'm going to elaborate more on the whole atheism thing and how I became one, my transition from a theist to an atheist. But for this episode, we're talking about caring for others. Not only helps others, but it actually makes us happier humans. It gives more meaning to our lives. So I guess I'm going to wrap it up. I'm going to leave you with that thought. I don't know. Try to do whatever you can do to help others. Pay it forward. Be kind to strangers and to those in need. And spread your love, and that'll make you happier, and it will help others with whatever shit they're dealing with. That's the bottom line. But I think the real change that we can actually do that could be national, you know, on a national scale, maybe even on a global scale, is changing laws. How Obama said, don't boo, vote. Is to vote, is to be active politically. This is so cliche, but I'm going to say it anyways. And take our country back. I can't believe I said that. It's so freaking cliche and cheesy, but really, that's what we need to do. But I encourage you, go to represent.us. Start there. Anything you can do. There are chapters all over the U.S. No matter where you live in the U.S., you can volunteer, you can donate even a few dollars, whatever you can. Go to a meeting, go meet with people of that chapter in your community. And I think that's a good start. Represent.us. Can't wait to get back home and be aggressively active. Anyways, my dear Earthlings, I'm going to put you back in the pod. Send you back to planet Earth. Hope you had a good time here. In 2 weeks, Adam Cartier is going to be here. Until then, I will see you next week. I love you. Thank you for being here up until now. Thank you for sticking around. And I will see you next week. 7 days. Get in the pod. Get the fuck out of here. Go back to Earth. Peace out, my peeps. See you next time.